whole area.
They've had a major problem with the concrete coming through the line. That's going to continue to create problems. And it's clear that we may see legislation before Christmas, which is basically putting a moratorium on toll leasing in the government until this administration buys some kind of a surface mark bill. Sometime meaning basically HR 25 or the detail, modified HR 25, which we submit ourselves in January. I guess what I'm saying is that I think we may have made very little progress on the overall energy policy front in the last 7 years. There are senators, there are congressmen, and there are many members of the public who have a much better understanding and a much better appreciation of the problem and the solutions than they had 6 months ago. But there seems to be, we've made very little progress, I think, on the basic willingness of either the Congress or the public to face up to some of the very tough decisions that need to be made and to accept some of those decisions, to accept some of the sacrifices, to live with some of the costs, whether they're pocketbook costs, if you're a consumer, or political costs, if you're a member of Congress or you're a president, and to accept those and move ahead. And that's quite troublesome because the old import clock is still ticking. 40 more today than we were in 1973. By 1977, if without any change in policies, we are continuing to our imports will be almost 50% of our overall oil requirements. We'll be shipping roughly $32 to $35 billion a year of oil of U.S. capital, a good part of which will not be coming back to the U.S. And if it does, even when it does come back, it comes back extremely long lag time. Plus just the overall problem of independence and vulnerability of 50% import level. Many of you who are around during the embargo of 73, you're probably familiar with some of the pressures that were put on this government due to the foreign policy. We were able to withstand those pressures, even though we had tremendous political upheaval at home and social stress resulting from the embargo. That was, however, only about 30% of our oil at that time. Just think about October, November, and December 73 and 30% embargo, and think about what it would be like in 50% or 60%, which could be here in 2 years if we don't start taking this back. And ask yourself some basic questions, you think. You know, what happens to the social fabric of an embargo situation twice as rough as it was? What happens to the president's flexibility in the international arena, a basic military capability in that kind of situation? And I think if you try to draw some answers to those kind of questions, you're going to get a feel on what the real cause of not doing something here to getting really going down the road to the real problem that you need. We've not made any substantive progress to date. General prospects are actually not particularly good right now, even though the education level has improved. We really are at the point where I think maximum number of students are basically willing to take some risk for their future, their political future, to make the best decisions.
Question started off with another. It seems to me that the basic problem. I very well stand the administration's reluctance to admit the failure of our foreign policy in the Middle East, certainly in 1973. The pervasive reluctance on the part of the administration to get up and frankly assert that the embargo and the oil price increases are part of a pattern of misbehavior on the part of the Soviets and their allies and the things they're working on. And that in the absence of that line to and the continuance of the praise of détente as a partnership, we're creating a sense of euphoria that makes it almost impossible to get the man in the street aware of the relationship between the price of the gallon of gasoline and Soviet and Israel. Now, isn't that something that your organization ought to be working on debate about?
Well, I think there's a potential question in there for you to express an issue that you raise here. I think it's no secret, that what happened in October 73 really did relate to some type of failure in foreign policy. OPEC tried for 15 years to put together a price increase and a production cutback and nationalization of the field. And they really could not pull it off. It took two events to pull it off. It took this country going from the 60s to the 70s and turning the import curve and starting to import substantial amounts from OPEC. Our own domestic production. It did take that physical reality. But also took that war to pull West, everyone in OPEC, to go APEC into a cohesive economic unit in mandatory demand. And I think whether or not this government wants to do that politically, the right response to the question whether it's a question or an issue. See it on time to time in the paper,
understanding, at least on my part, perhaps on others, of the specific responsibilities that FEA has and the authority which they exercise within the government, because it is an agency. There are other agencies which also report to the president, who should be responsive to his dictates, and therefore a lot of the conflicts which appear within the administration from agency to agency presumably should be, one should be able to ride across those other things. Could you at least give us some idea as to what your, not only your responsibilities, but your authorities are?
Okay. That's a good question, I think. Government itself, in the energy area, is not unique. Government is complete with overlap and duplication. Very hard to get a clean organization for under the responsibility. Well, I think that when FEA was created, it was envisioned to have a number of responsibilities. One of the biggest responsibilities was to run the allocation and price control the regulatory program, which we've been doing roughly half of what we're doing. They were also given designated as the agency to run the conversion program. So the two basic regulatory responsibilities of the agency. At the same time, the mandate of the agency and the statute is to be the overall energy policy agency to look at, continually assess the nation's overall energy situation, both on the supply and demand side, overall policy. And to be concerned with and do policy work in and make recommendations regarding all energy resources, both actually reminded of this mandate a couple of weeks ago when President Biden, if they're facing serious climate problems, clear in that particular case that by 1979 they will be curtailed rather than protected. There's nothing that will happen Ms. Wayne has been dealing with the FTC, the Department here. Everybody's got some kind of war here, but remind us, when those lines cross, and they can supply drop below their ability to buy their revenue customers, and the FDA, or where they, you know, hit the fan. So we have, it's in that kind of sense that we have to be concerned in our minds with every type of energy resource that we use. We have concentrated over the last year and a half on the oil and the oil and gas area. But we are increasing our concentration in the coal area. And I'm now starting a major effort in the nuclear area. So just recently hired a very capable nuclear expert, Phil Yumko, out of the power industry. We hope he'll be on board by September 1st and he's going to take a very active role in nuclear policy issues, whether it be regulatory, regulatory kind of issues, or whether it be scientific and technological kind of issues. We're not concerned in this case being the need to augment the nuclear power in this country. Work on all of the various obstacles, standing the way of 47 nuclear power plants a day, 219 plus. Now, again, we don't have any specific authority to make somebody do something that they may not otherwise do. We do have, I think, the basic policy, overall policy.
You exercise a policy responsibility without any authority. Now, I understand you just said there is no authority.
We have no authority to regulate nuclear power plants. We have no authority to speed up on some application in the NRC or at the state level. We have no basic legal authority in the area to actually force an action which might not otherwise occur.
That occurs across the board, regardless of whether it's nuclear or coal or oil.
Except in the oil gas. We have major authorities in the oil area and some of the gas.
What are those authorities?
Well, right now, they're basically the allocation of those prices. That will likely expire on the 31st, and our mind will hope will not be reinstituted. But at that point in time, we will have a regulatory authority. We will continue to have the best data as far as our ability to collect data from nuclear sources, from oil companies, gas companies, from electric utilities, and so forth. Our generic agency actors, they have very good data mandate and authority to collect data. And to the effect of the dependent production of data, we likely will have by November the responsibility to develop and implement the reserve program. And we do expect to see that bill passed by Congress this Christmas. We're likely to have some emergency storage done by October to deal with the gas shortage this winter. That will be severe. In terms of other kinds of authority, I would imagine that will come with the policy responsibility, strong data authority, and cold conversion authority to give you reserve.
What you're saying is FEA can get the authority if the situation gets serious enough. But there's overwhelming evidence the situation is dramatically serious right now. In other words, if you just look at imports, it's getting worse and the actions aren't taking place. How bad does it have to get before you feel there will be additional authority granted to the FEA to take action in those areas where the crisis isn't overwhelmingly evident to the American people and to the Congress.
Yeah, that's, I think that's a very good point. We've now got congressmen calling us the last couple of weeks to tell them by date on the gas shortage again to kind of leak out. We haven't released it publicly yet. Some of the congressmen couldn't get a hold of it. And just the phones are off the wall. What kind of authority do we need to handle this? It's really kind of classic kind of government syndrome. We really needed some authority about 5 years ago to avoid this. We didn't get it, so now we've got to go into crisis management mode. But we'll end up with it.
This area, can you just have higher influence on Congress?
We think it may. We think that the data will be becoming public about the first
day. The data and the actual crisis.
And the actual crisis, and in fact, climate change is a good thing that we can get. That's been modeled up too.
On the coal business, the president has vetoed twice the strip mining here. Can you give us some idea what was in the bill that was so objectionable? It was the extra cost for strip mining, or was it prohibition of certain actions of coal mining altogether?
Okay, I think from the administration's point of view, I could give you a list of at least 100 problems. It was a serious problem with H.R. 25. The fact of the matter is that through the 4 year period that bill has been developed, we acquiesced at certain points in the way and some of those problems. But it was one of those situations where every country might say, okay, on this particular problem, and hope that you can trade that off against another problem that might be acquiesced in another. By the time I got down to H.R. 25, all of those things were major problems in the market. At the same time, we did not feel at that point in time since we had acquiesced. But that there were still 8 or 10 significant problems in that bill that the mayor didn't detail. Now, some of the problems related to federal-state relations. That bill, in our mind, basically was a preemption of federal or state law kind of issue that is, in many ways, bad public policy. Never. We also had major problems with the standards, when the standards applied there. These folk limitations. 1962 and 63 keeps were a problem. And by 1971, the technologies were developed to deal with these folks. H.R. 25 really had provisions relating to these folks. It went back to 1962 as if there had been no technological progress. And in fact, because of those standards, we're going to prohibit the mining of a lot of coal today that we're currently going to mine on these slopes in a very environmentally acceptable way, which avoids the problem of the 50s and the 60s. There were probably 8 or 10 of those kinds of things that we thought was incredibly strong regulatory requirements that we will not take account of technological considerations. You also had a couple of these. We had a couple of other things that handled. You also had tremendous problems in the bill regarding interpretation of certain provisions. Alluvial Valley floors is one of the popular ones in the press. If you read the provision relating to alluvial valley floors in the bill, it clearly had in one sentence two completely different interpretations of alluvial valley floors. Under one interpretation, you could have mined the entire west, even areas you would not want to touch with 10-foot pole, but you could have had it if that was an interpretation. Under the other interpretation, you would have shut down business. That
both of them were there, and the conference committee, for this panel problem, the conference committee fought over those two things. The Senate had one interpretation, the House had another. They could not resolve it. They said, let's put them both down and let the court resolve. We had 8 or 10 of those goodies in that bill, which not only would have a major impact on short term, but also raise the other general problem today. Any type of regulatory activity in our mind that is basically authorizing statute ought to be a precise range to make it. Given the propensity for court involvement and the delays that occur when you have court involvement, you can lose more ground on your energy and attendance to go over and court delays and confusion else I can imagine. Just my good public policy, the life laws, that's probably that tears the ramifications. And tough, again, the body of the board should have cleared up that plus other definitional problems in the system as well. In our mind, we have a fairly high risk property to put that on the street, given our oil import situation, lack of drivers. Never say it was another home bill in January. And I say you can't say it's a favor. Good information.
I think this morning we talked a little bit with Dr. Simmons on this question of where we would be going towards perhaps an energy board or some type of organization that would help finance. Work with the industry in managing, encouraging this very large increase of federal assistance, private assistance that we're going to need for an expanded energy program.
Okay, I think that's a good question. I'm just thinking I'm not particularly satisfied with the current organizational arrangement for the energy. Not because we don't get to be able to have more, we certainly have more. I do think the government's basic energy organization is still inadequate and needs reworking.
Is your favorite the czar kind of concept?
I'm not sure I favor the czar kind of concept. At least the type of czar concept implied in the Senate Energy Mobilization. I think we would favor an agency that had the basic FDA policy and data responsibilities and some of the regulatory responsibilities that had a few students fully filled in, plus the basic utility responsibilities that are involved in today, coupled with further responsibilities in R&D, and coupled with the oil and gas and coal responsibilities of the Department of Interior. Anything I would like to see is the organization department security. You have 5 assistant secretaries over there and flip through that OTA police department one way or another. And I just think there's enough already going on that could be cleaned up. We don't know what the house done. But at some point in time, we do need to address this expedition. And it does need to be cleaned up. We create on the OCS area, so we've got some obstacles. On the part of the bureaucracy running these programs, and the lack of communication, if you made our own mistake, we could create a lot of these problems. And if we resolve it, it's better organized. It comes to the question of whether to go the next step and create something like the National Energy Mobilization Board with super powers in this area. I think at this point, we would probably not be in favor of that type of activity.
Why?
I think for several reasons. Because we're yet to be persuaded. And just looking at the National Energy Selection Board, I see no evidence to convince me that the Government Energy Mobilization Board can build a new pipeline from the west any faster than the private industry can do it. The only thing that the Energy Mobilization Board would have is an advantage that the private institution would not have in this case, is the ability to override and debunk a number of environmental regulations.
That's a lot.
That's a little issue, though, isn't it?
Okay, but I think it might be equally valid to ask for the authority for some agency to have that type of authority without also then, the only way I can have that authority is physically go out and do the project itself, to build a nuclear power plant, to build a pipeline or whatever.
It doesn't take that. I mean, it only takes the capability to bust open the bottlenecks that are within the government itself.
That, I think, is probably the key in terms of the authority. We do need that type of authority to
might need some finance.
Real ability to go out to bust the bottlenecks in a reasonable way. No, not just
The implication of that uncertainty, though, with regard to the financial community and the resources that are really ready to be applied to it, are just absolutely profound. It is a self-defeating environment we're in. People don't want to put money into coal because they don't know what EPA is going to do. And they don't want to put money into nuclear because they don't know whether we got a problem or we don't have a problem, because people say we've got a manageable situation. Other people say we've got to do all kinds of R&D. And who is, in a sense, who is there to believe, in a sense, with regard to any of these areas that are of such concern to the public?
I think that, let me just tell you right now, we do have some items under review on FDA, and we'll have the president probably ready next week when he returns. We do have a concern with some bottlenecks that we think have no substantial merit from an environmental or health or any other kind of point of view. They're just bureaucratic bottlenecks. We really do think that the government may need some of that authority. We don't translate that into a big mobilization board, five commissioners in the council, but we do look at that authority as having some real merit. The other area we're looking at quite seriously is the whole issue of energy financing for the energy facilities. We have gone through an agonizing process on this over the last 9 months, on the basic position of there were no energy financing difficulties that could not be resolved by clearing up of government policy in some area or improving the capital markets and so forth. I don't think we believe that anymore, quite frankly. We're looking at continuing to try to nail down the exact nature of the problem and the various alternative solutions. But things really have changed, as you well know. There was one thing for electric utilities when they have $300 million coal-fired generating plants. Another thing for that same utility when they have $3 billion nuclear plant, which is going to cost. The RDS pipeline.
That's a 4-unit nuclear.
Right, a large complex.
Well, it's unfair to put things in the same way. 300 million versus we're talking about entirely different things. And I think this is one of the things that confuses the public. To talk about apples and oranges in the same breath, basically, and it looks to them as though nuclear cost $3 billion and coal only this. Reality, we're talking about an entirely different.
You mean entirely different? They're both generating electricity.
Yes, they're both generating electricity. We're talking about vastly different amounts.
You are talking about 15 to 10
different. At the most, yeah.
Right. They don't impact on 10.
Right. Okay, that's right.
Yeah.
But there still is substantial capital cost differential between coal fire and
No.
10-15%?
No.
It's disputed. Is that the case?
No, sir.
Even the 15% is disputed by Mr. Davis of the Texas. He says in the case of coal, you ought to add the extra loading stock, which the railways would use to transport the coal from the mountain states to the Midwest or the East. And you have to add probably even some rail lines from the Boston State. And
okay, if you look at that in
your account, then then it is zero deficit.
But if you look at it from that perspective, I think you're entirely right. You know, there's two cost differences. But you have to look at the structure of who's doing the financing. If a utility is going to build a coal-fired plant, it will finance to build a nuclear plant. Its capital requirements are going to be much greater. But it will not pay for the coal cost.
But isn't the question of the ultimate cost to the consumer, and it's already been well indicated that the ultimate cost to the consumer is about 40% less when the power is derived from a nuclear plant versus the other. So it's that we have to keep in perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the theory. In fact, the way the marketplace is working doesn't make it come to pass.
It doesn't come to pass.
In our discussion with the utility executives today, they're canceling nuclear power plants for one reason. They don't see the cash flow and the capital capacity to build that nuclear power plant.
Yes, sir.
They're canceling for some other reasons, too, but there are a lot of them being canceled for just that reason.
What they've said to me is that that's something to leave to their successor. Right. They make the decision today on nuclear for 10 years from now. It costs them money. They know that their successor can make the decision for coal in 5 years, or for oil in 6 years, or for gas turbines in 7 years, and still meet the 10-year point. So why put heavy investment in now? And that's kind of the problem that we have to bring to bear in the government.
And that's where your financing arrangements could help ameliorate that by some types of guarantees or various sorts of things. It could also go to the rolling stock for to help out the coal industry and other things like that, as well as the
I think that's capital. I think the basic one I watched on the capital requirements have just gone up many fold. The shift away from oil and the desire and the need to go to nuclear. We already get pipelines. 5 years ago, we thought that pipeline would have cost $1 million. They were looking at $10 billion. That's double the assets of all the members of that consortium. There's no way that group of gas utilities can finance $10 billion worth of pipeline, even though that may be the most cost effective way of getting to the consumer, getting that gas plant from the old bay.
But isn't part of the.
Just a couple more, let me call it up.
If I may, as a layman, I'm going to try and offer a heretical remark, an iconoclastic remark. You see, I listened to some of you gentlemen who are versed in the intricacies of, and I'm looking at for the layman, the average American citizen. I say it from the perspective even of the concern of AEI, which is essentially devoted to the idea of educating the American public through energy independence and various resources. And the American citizen says, a plague on all of your houses. Your administration erred this one, the whole work. We're being ripped off. We're being ripped off down the line, they say. And he's impatient with hearing all of this talk of shifting responsibility. He sees the oil companies. He sees, if you will, utilities or some. He sees other industries. Because we are paying the bill. We're all floating around in Washington here, running from one office to another, yakking away one to the other. Prices are going to go up at the end of August. The president is on vacation. There's going to be a speech on energy tomorrow. And we're going to pay the bill. We get held up by OPEC. Some Arab sheiks are going to throw the bill at us. We're going to pay the bill. And nobody has the guts enough to say an end to all of this. And that's why you made the point about they're not taking this whole matter seriously. Because the average American citizen out in the street there doesn't think Washington is taking it seriously. Doesn't think the president is taking it seriously. Doesn't think you fellas are taking it seriously. And there's a great deal of pent-up anger and resentment at what they see is happening throughout the bureaucracy here. Well, you can't throw the responsibilities back that the American public doesn't understand it or grasp it. They see that you fellows don't grasp it. You don't have the guts to take the nettle in your hands. And if you will, even for Frank Czar, for you, whoever it is, to tell the president, the time has come to stand up, say America is going to have a foreign policy that's going to be tough and firm, And then we're going to be able to come to the American people and say, whatever bill we have to pay, we're going to pay. And not hear all those cockamamie stories which are going around about what's happening in the State Department, what's happening in your department, what's happening all over. The guy at the pump is going to pay. And the person who has to pay the heating oil bill is going to pay. And they see prices going up and up and up, and everybody's on vacation. So they say, the average American citizen says, as I am saying, what the devil's going on here? They're playing games with the American, and the American, average American citizen says, a plague in all of your houses. So I offer this remark. I don't know what answer there could be about the, whatever the complexities of the situation is, but I'm talking from the point of view of nobody showing the necessary, the requisite guts to stand up and develop an overall policy vis-a-vis OPEC, vis-a-vis oil companies, vis-a-vis the need to project what has to be projected here. They see simple immobilization and paralysis. Now, to the extent that all of us can get involved in trying to cut through the underbrush, then to that extent we'll regain the confidence of the American citizen, we'll drive back down to 55, he'll go back to whatever has to be done. For a while it was done, it did hold down to 55, and this is what the American citizen sees. And I don't offer this as a question, and I don't offer this as any personal criticism, but I wonder whether some of the people around this table see that fundamentally this is what we're talking about.
Well, yeah.
I suspect that's very much true. Let me just say that on behalf of John Calgary.
I assure you.
Yeah, I agree 100% with what you just said. The problem is how, in a complex organization like this government or ours, do you reestablish credibility on this subset problem when our overall policy is to pretend that the economy is working? And until the president and secretary of state are willing to get up and point out the imperfections in it and demonstrate to the American people that one gross imperfection is the fact that we're becoming hostage to OPEC nations as a result of the imperfections that they've done, and nothing but the man in the street to believe that it's anything but some kind of a ripoff by big oil.
Why don't you do it the other way around, then? Start with the protection of the well, the self-interest, if you will, the well-being of the American people, the pocketbook, the human conditions, the social conditions, and then you move from there to self. So where's our foreign policy? You know, set some criteria, which I think we are in the business of doing. Criteria about the price of the pump, about protection of the homeowner, etc., etc. Start from there, and then logically move to foreign policy.
Sure, we can, and I think we must, but the basic problem is to get top leadership to be willing to confirm the fact.
Is it tragedy, though, that you can't excite the public that there's something going to happen, that that gasoline goes up 10 cents, or 15 cents, when it strikes like it did last time, you've got it around. They just don't believe me and say, nobody's talking. I go right to the top. And that's not going to happen. And you've got another problem. I think you got a person's document to talk about it. The gasoline dealer, well, I can't understand. And then I what is it? I think this thing, you know, this thing goes up 15 cents in my area. We don't have riot drivers. But this is where you're going to get down.
The poor of America are not going to stand by if this thing goes up. That's phenomenal. Doesn't it? But the poor is where, that's where you're going to get. So, from every, from every. Just stick on that question, then we go back down. Okay. The thing that, along the lines of the suggested here and that concerns to remark, the thing that I think troubles me and would probably trouble others is that there are, in fact, a number of actions that could be taken, which are, as I perceive them at least, within the purview of and the authority of the administration of the FEA. From the standpoint of, one, the supply side as well as from the standpoint of a conservation end, to at least make the public aware of its participation and to give them the feeling that, yes, things are being done by the administration, they are participating, and if the price does go up, it's out of necessity rather than because all other things are being forgotten. For example, there are very simple things that one could do that are certainly within your thing. Not that they are the be-all, end-all. All I'm saying is, why, for example, doesn't the FDA administer a program such that all of the lights and main arteries of cities are on a program basis so that we save 10, 12, 15, or 20% of our fuel in city driving where most of it is consumed. That's a simple thing that you could do that could demonstrate to the public that you're doing everything to conserve, and if the price has to go up for other purposes, it can be done. Or airline schedules or whatever the case may be, these are things that are in your control, in your purview, and nothing happens except we're fighting among ourselves in Congress. Why? Why is that?
Oh, I think these last questions really are the fundamental question is why aren't we doing this? I think we probably have to grapple as far as that question as anything else. But you run into bottlenecks, roadblocks every step of the way. We have an effect, for example, that makes a whole lot of sense to reduce the line twice and get the load level up. You get fuel. There are people on the side who are convinced that it may not happen. And with substantial clout, you have to face those things realistically. Part of the problem I think the American people have, they don't know who to listen to. They don't know who's telling them the truth. Because every time somebody stands up and says one thing, there's somebody there to say, oh, he's lying to you. I know there are several areas of the country that in 5 years are not going to have enough electric power to run the basic industries in those areas. You go out and say that in those communities, and there'll be five other people coming along right behind you and blow all kinds of smoke in the air and all of this. Well, how does the average citizen sort out, who's telling them what the situation is? We have statements all the time, oh, the gasoline price is going to go 75, 80, 90 cents a dollar. All that does is confuse people. It's not going to happen. And people making those statements know it's not factually the case, but they've got other agendas to play. How do you get at those kinds of problems to try to get some kind of reasonable debate going on among the people that might be saying the comments? I don't know.
Well, it's all very complicated, and there are no obvious answers, and this is a democracy.
John? No. Thank you very much. Thank you.
But I have that one more point.
We had a better road on our 25-mile program than we had on our 39-mile program.
objected to the judicial order here by charging.
Okay.